Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, with me today, sometimes Film Stage Show guest, William Graham.
Hey, guys.
I keep doing that just because of Hannibal.
That's all right.
I almost said behavioral psychologist, noted empath.
I prefer that.
And disgraced FBI agent Will Graham.
I haven't watched last week's episode, or this week's episode.
Right, because they changed it to Saturday.
Yeah.
And I totally forgot. So I woke up this morning, I walk upstairs.
Wait. Introduce Danny.
Oh, right. Danny King is here, too. I walk upstairs. We also have Film Stage Show contributor, writer, and co-host of this show, sometimes, Danny King.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. So going back to Hannibal, I walk upstairs this morning, and one of my roommates is watching it. I'm like, oh, you catching up on old episodes? He's like, no, this is one from last night. I literally ran out of the room. I was like, no spoilers. Oh god, it was a nightmare. So I gotta do that. I also gotta watch True Detective tonight. Guys, TV is really, it's really killing me right now.
I'm behind on True Detective by like 2 or 3 episodes.
People have been giving this season a lot of shit. I'm really enjoying it.
You know, it's a show.
It is a show.
Yeah.
Danny, what are you watching on TV recently?
I sort of plan on binging True Detective at some point. I haven't started it.
I honestly think that True Detective currently is suffering from binge culture. I think that people have lost the ability to really hang in there with a TV show.
Oh, I see.
Like, because if you were to watch House of Cards once a week, like, you would realize how fucking crazy and stupid that show is. But because you're trying to binge it over a single weekend so y'all can talk about it on Monday, and I do this,
exactly. Yep.
I'm like, oh, it doesn't matter that none of this makes any sense. I just want to know how it ends.
Well, and that's the benefit of their storytelling kind of mantra is we don't have to, like, give you something to chew on for a while. We realize that we're just going to release it all at once,
yeah.
And that changes the way that you kind of make a show and stuff like that. I think True Detective is just suffering from it's not the first season.
Yeah.
People want the first season.
People want the first season all over again.
And the great thing is,
Nick Pizzolatto was saying, I'm not giving you that same thing.
Yeah.
And I am a fan of L.A. Noir, so I dig it. I enjoy it. I will say that anyone, like, binging, when you go on a binge when you're drinking, you're not sitting there sniffing the glass, tasting it, chewing it, and then spitting it into a bucket. You've literally lost control. You're a sloppy mess, and no one wants to be around you. So think of that when you talk about binge watching something, because you're taking the most awful, terrible, consumptive verb and applying it to your movie and TV watching habits.
Well, I think most people, when they binge watch something, they do that. It's like, how many hours of sleep can I get?
Every season of True Detective,
like,
I have watched.
Let me get one more.
While I was either hungover or sick, because I was like, I can't leave the couch anyway. I should watch. Or did I say True Detective?
Yeah, I
meant House of Cards.
Okay.
Because the last couple of times House of Cards has been released around Valentine's Day. And we have parties, and I just, like, have a party, get wasted, and then I can't move for the next 2 days, so I watch House of Cards. Anyway, welcome to the Film Stage Show, where we should be talking about films. This has been a brief tangent on binge-watching culture in True Detective. Should we talk about Ballers? No, we shouldn't. No one should.
Have you watched that?
I have. It's kind of fun, but it's really not worth talking about.
Okay.
Silicon Valley's my show. Right now.
Silicon Valley is my shit, dog. I also have been watching a lot of Key and Peele recently, so there's where that came from.
What about Law and Order SVU?
It used to be my thing when, oddly enough, I was like 13.
Okay.
I'm
going through a bit of a phase.
I'd like come home and my parents would be watching Law and Order, and I'd be like, all right, I'll sit down and watch this. I love Stabler. I think a lot of where I think of common modern masculinity comes from Elliot Stabler. Yeah, I played by Christopher Maloney.
Yeah,
what are we talking about?
I don't know. I'm so lost.
Well, all I was gonna say is I've only been watching the ones that are on Netflix, and I think it's.
Oh my God! Is SVU on Netflix?
Yeah.
Oh, I just lost my life.
But the first season that's on Netflix.
This is terrible. I have to break up with my girlfriend and quit my job now.
But the first season on Netflix is the one after Stabler, so I haven't seen any of him.
Oh, yeah. It's not worth watching, really.
I mean, it's got Ice-T.
Well, yeah, Ice-T is still there. So we're here today to talk about Marvel's Ant-Man. Playing theaters now, hit wide release. Director Peyton Reed. This is the movie that famously was supposed to be directed by Edgar Wright, based off a screenplay by him and Joe Cornish, but he left. We actually talked about that on a previous episode when it happened. So that's the tight, tight turnaround that these are going through.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into that, let me remind everyone to follow us on Twitter at Filmstage Show. We have lots of cool behind-the-scenes stuff for the movies, which I know you're interested in, not the show, which I know you could probably give a shit about. And you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And you can also comment on the pages that these are posted on thefilmstage.com. So make sure to do that. It's a good time for everyone involved. And we try to write back as often as we can. So if there's a thing you want to say to us, say it to our face, man. Say it to our face. You can also give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. We love those as well. Aside from our random and literally, honestly, completely unplanned digression into HBO and binge-watching culture, has anyone watched the third season of Orange is the New Black yet?
I didn't even finish the first season.
I will say that Orange is the New Black would hold up week to week. I think that's a quality show. Anyway, aside from that, we're only going to talk about Ant-Man today. And yeah, that's going to be it. So that's enough of our random preamble. I don't even know how I'm going to edit this episode. Let's get into Ant-Man. Starring Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas, Evangeline Lilly, and Michael Peña. As well as Corey Stahl in a, I would say, heroic turn as a crazy-ass villain. And this is about a Marvel superhero who has the ability to shrink down to the size of an ant. So here's the trailer.
Imagine a soldier the size of an insect. The ultimate secret weapon.
You give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
By knowing I. Scott, I've been watching you for a while. You're different. And I believe everyone deserves a shot at redemption. Do you?
Absolutely. My days of breaking into places and stealing stuff are over. What do you want me to do?
I want you to break into a place and steal some stuff.
Makes sense.
So Ant-Man, this is an embattled production, and I'm gonna make a bit of a thing right now. Let's not talk about this movie as though Edgar Wright could have directed it, because he didn't. And what does that get us? Nothing. It's dominated the conversation.
Sure. The only thing, though, the only caveat, the catch there is he did co-write the screenplay, so it's
right.
Him and it's Joe hard Cornish, to know
who directed it. Attack the Block did do the screenplay, which then got went over by Paul Rudd and Adam McKay.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a curious thing. It's interesting to think about what parts of this film might have been his.
Absolutely.
I'm going to have to say that the Michael Peña monologues were probably his. Because they were the best part of the film, in my estimation. But I'm going to say that this wasn't directed by him. It was directed by Peyton Reed, who did the incredible and not talked about enough Down with Love, starring Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger. And I think we should take it how it is. So Edgar Wright, not on it. Peyton Reed, on it. We're talking about Peyton Reed's film, which is Ant-Man. So let's talk about it. Danny King, it's been a while since you've been on the show. Why don't you give us your opinion of Ant-Man?
I liked Ant-Man. It had sort of been a while since I'd seen not only a Marvel movie, but sort of a wide release on opening night, or actually saw it Thursday night. So it was strange to be back in that kind of environment. Like right, even before the movie started, like the Lucasfilm logo came up and people were clapping for the Star Wars trailer. And then throughout the movie, you know, people were clapping at sort of the Avengers references, which are sort of the only things in the movie that fell flat for me, just because I haven't been keeping up with each film. So they sort of went over my head. And apparently the opening scene has characters from other Marvel movies, and I didn't.
And
yeah, it does.
Yeah.
That went over my head.
Really? Didn't you see the first Avenger, Captain America?
Yeah.
You didn't recognize the woman in that?
Okay.
I didn't.
Like she's really age or makeup in that.
Yeah,
in that.
But I mean she also had the TV show, which I didn't watch, but I heard was amazing. So
yeah. I recognized her name in the credits.
Haley Atwell, Peggy Carter.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I had to see it the second time through to even make sure it was her,
because
I was looking at her and I was like, wait, what? And then I watched it this morning and I was still unsure. So they did a number on her face,
I guess. And John Slattery, I think his only appearance is Howard Stark in Iron Man 2.
Yeah, he was retconned. Because it was what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Simon something? The younger guy from Captain America?
He did the Devil's Double. I can't remember the actor's name. Yeah.
He was Howard Stark in World War II era in Captain America the First Avenger.
Yeah.
But every time that he's played something from like the 60s/70s on, he's been done by John Slattery.
I just can't see him turning into John Slattery.
I can't either, but I will never complain about getting some John Slattery in my life.
No. As soon as I saw him, I was like, yes.
And it's,
keep talking.
Yeah. I was sad that he didn't show up more, but like in this world, he's been dead for a little bit. That's not even a spoiler.
But,
he's just an old man.
Danny, like.
Okay, so Danny, the Avengers references were going over your head.
Yeah, so. But what appealed to me about the movie is that for the most part, it sort of works as like a standalone caper with a nice self-aware sense of humor. I think the casting is pretty good too. Michael Douglas isn't necessarily someone I would expect to show up in a Marvel movie, but I think he gets quite a bit to work with. I also like Paul Rudd generally, but there were a few moments in this movie where he seemed to assert himself in ways that even surprised me. Like there's one scene that's a really heartfelt, I mean, it's sort of workmanlike, but it's a very heartfelt dialogue between Michael Douglas and Evangeline Lilly and Paul Rudd. Yeah. Who plays his daughter, and Paul Rudd literally interrupts it and is just like, that was very heartfelt. And it was this moment where it felt like Paul Rudd was bored watching the scene and he's like, I'm going to make this more interesting, which is sort of, I sort of think of Paul Rudd as like this laid back comic presence. And so I sort of enjoyed these few moments where he almost asserted himself and was just like, I have to take over and make this funny or else it's going to lose the momentum.
We're losing the tone, guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something funny. Hold on.
So I really enjoyed that. I think Peyton Reed does a good job of handling the visual scales. I actually haven't seen any of his romantic comedies, but I have heard some good things, especially about Down with Love.
Okay.
And
they nail it and it's amazing. So anyway, that's me. Well,
that sounds really good.
Yeah. You should check it out. Everyone, Down with Love. Check it out.
but yeah, the first set piece when Paul Rudd puts on the costume and he sort of goes through almost each floor of his apartment building, That was really fantastic. It goes from like the bath to a dance party. And I think in one shot he's like cupped underneath a woman's heel.
Yeah.
That was pretty great.
The seemingly never ending dance party that's happening on the floor below him.
Yeah. Just, you know, you couldn't hear it before, but, and yeah, you know, you mentioned the Michael Pena thing, and there's a lot of funny humor with Paul Rudd's sort of motley team of criminals. Like, he sort of is the only kind of smart one. The rest are just sort of there for quips, but they're very funny.
Yeah.
Bobby Cannavale just keeps showing up in the most random movies. Because I just saw Spy recently.
Yes.
In that.
Yeah,
he's
like,
great in that too.
He is actually. Yeah, he's really good. And he gets funnier in this towards the end when the circumstances around him are so absurd and he has to still kind of try to play the straight man. So yeah, I would say overall I was pleasantly surprised by Ant-Man. Thumbs up.
All right. Thumbs up from Danny for Ant-Man. Let's see if Bill Graham feels the same.
One thing I kind of want to mention is the fact that leading into this film, I didn't have very high expectations. For most of the Marvel films, I usually come away with pretty high regards for them. I think overall, as kind of a studio that's been making a lot of films that aren't necessarily easy to make, market, and then, you know, ultimately fulfill fan expectations and things like that, they've been doing a pretty darn good job. The one real sore mark is kind of the second Thor movie. But coming into this with the Edgar Wright stuff, with the trailers that I had seen, I just really didn't think this film was going to nail the tone. And I'm very, very happy that I laughed so much during this movie. It's a shame that the marketing doesn't get that across well enough, in my opinion.
Like, they tried to early on. One of the first trailers, like, Michael Douglas says, "I want you to be the Ant-Man,"
and yeah, he questions, like,
"Can we change
is it
the
too
name?"
Late?
Like,
and that joke fell completely flat for me when I watched it in the trailer. There were some other jokes in the other trailer that they released where I just didn't laugh. The one thing that they got right was that visual gag with the train, and that was that's obviously one of the biggest laughs in the movie itself. But look, it's easy to make a movie funny. I say that, and then there's tons of comedies that come out every single year that are not very funny.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think this character in particular, if you know the history of him, he's always been kind of a goofball, kind of a screwball kind of character. His history is kind of peppered with a lot of like really bad things. I'm not sure why. He seems like just such a screwball kind of character, but apparently different iterations of him have had some wife beating issues and various things like that.
Well, I think that was the Hank Pym Ant-Man.
Yeah. Yep.
That's maybe why they went with the Scott Lang Ant-Man.
So
I don't know.
I don't know.
We should have had my friend Dan Gavazdin, who is on for the Age of Ultron one, because he's a total Marvel nerd, and he could tell us all this stuff. But we're just going to go off of what we have for this film, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. Overall, I think the film really nails some of the visual kind of aesthetics that it's going for. It plays with size change a lot, and it has a lot of fun doing that. A lot of people have made it kind of, or have referred to this film as kind of, you know, the next one of the microscopic movies, kind of in the vein of like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or any of these other films. And it never really plays in that tone. It never makes being small feel dangerous. Which I thought was kind of a very weird thing. Of course, if you know a little bit about the Ant-Man kind of power, it's that he's small, but you can't like step on him. Like, that's not going to work.
It's this is the thing that has actually kept this movie in my mind. The way they explain the Pym particle, which is really actually, it seems like a vial of red juice. So I don't know where the particle comes into it. They don't explain it, but I like the alliteration. He shrinks, but it's because it shrinks the amount of space between his atoms. So it's like, it's not him losing mass. It's him like becoming super dense, basically, which is why he can like still exert force like a man.
Sure. Yeah. And they do kind of play with that dynamic. They definitely touch on that and have a lot of fun with it. The thing they do kind of lose aspects of it, like when he lands on certain things, like a ant, you would think that he would just squash the ant,
right? Because he cracks a tile floor,
exactly,
and dents a fucking car hood.
Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's certain things that they obviously take liberties with, but hey, you know, I'm not going to complain when I'm watching a Marvel superhero movie and try and make it everything, you know, line up precisely.
Yeah.
I think, like I said, the action they have a lot of fun with. They do a really good job of giving Paul Rudd a lot to kind of work on. He shows a lot of dramatic range, I think, in this film, which I was kind of surprised by. I didn't find anything whenever he had to be really dramatic. I didn't find any of that stuff necessarily falling flat. Evangeline Lilly is great in it. I really, really like Corey Stoll. Just as an actor in general, I'm glad that they chose to not make him wear a wig in this film. I think he looks terrible with a wig. And
what does he have to wear a wig in?
Oh, you don't watch The Strain.
Oh, I've heard about his wig in The Strain. Yeah,
it's awful. It is awful.
I want to watch it. I've been thinking about it. It's in the second season now, right?
Yep.
I guess I should just binge watch the first season. Am I right?
First season's kind of wishy-washy. Second season so far, awesome.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe I'll just skip ahead then.
You could do that. Yeah.
I could do that. I'll just read the Wikipedia. Yeah, no, I like him as an actor. He was great in Nonstop.
Yeah.
Everyone everyone who is on this podcast contractually has to love Nonstop.
Oh, yeah.
He was also, I just realized this, he was Hemingway in Midnight in Paris.
Yep. I don't know if he had hair in that. I can't remember.
He totally did. He was Hemingway.
Okay.
Hemingway had hair until he died, I think. But yeah, Midnight in Paris. Corey Stoll with hair.
More hair.
He was great as Hemingway. Oh my God.
I really like him as Yellow Jacket in this film. They don't give him a whole lot to work with.
No,
I think it's more, I really like the suit that he wears. I think the suit is intimidating as hell.
It's pretty hard. I won't lie.
I think that just works once he dons the suit. His motivations and things like that are really kind of just damn dumb.
Oh, it literally seems like he's just crazy.
Yeah. I don't understand his motivation at all. What else? The music is great. Yeah. I really like the tonal shifts. Overall, I don't know. Like I really, really enjoyed seeing this movie. Obviously I saw it again this morning. So, I enjoyed it. And it also doesn't quite give us the same MacGuffin, that Marvel movies are kind of famous for now.
It's not a blue beam going into the sky.
Yeah. What it is it's literally another person. Like, yeah. It's just a fight.
It's a dearmament treaties. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. The movie benefits a lot from having that.
And one other thing, I really like the idea of the Ant-Man and the Pym particle and the way that they kind of tie the Yellow Jacket suit into being this kind of crazy super weapon. Like they do a really good job of selling that this could be a very bad thing in the wrong hands.
The crazy thing is, And this is like, I enjoyed this movie, I'll say off the bat. I thought this was, and this would mean more if this were any other series of movies, the most fun I've had at a Marvel movie since Guardians of the Galaxy. But that was like last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That was last August.
And I enjoyed the hell out of The Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
In a completely different way. Like that was a fun movie, but it was also like action packed, and it was a good, interesting film. But like as far as just unadulterated cinematic fun, like Ant-Man is good. It does the exact opposite of everything that Avengers 2 Age of Ultron did, which just bludgeoned me into a pile of apathy. Yeah. So this has reinvigorated me once again. The playing of the villain, he's the most cartoonishly villainous villain that ever villained. Like, you talk about how the movie sells how this could be a bad thing. His, like, commercial presentation was, like, only about how this could be a bad thing.
Exactly.
It wasn't even, like, imagine if we could shrink into a patient and, like, remove their cancer one cell at a time.
Yep.
It was literally, like, imagine if we could put a guy in a suitcase and he could fucking murder anyone we wanted to.
Yep.
Like
just
imagine,
weapons applications.
Yeah, imagine
That's
if
it.
We had an army of supermen who had articulated arms with lasers that could just kill everyone. And it was like it was the strangest, I don't even know how to put it, like presentation. It was like if someone had made an atomic bomb and didn't say, "This is a horrifying thing, but it may be our best option to end this ugly war." And if the person who made the atomic bomb, instead of saying that, had said, "Look at this shit. We could kill everyone. No one will mess with us. This is great. Let's just make a movie about us dropping this on Britain, and people will just back the hell off." It was the strangest, most obviously evil thing in the world. This guy wasn't even trying to hide it. It was like, why should we have to have global oversight? If we were the size of an ant with laser beams, we could do whatever the fuck we wanted.
Well, it is funny because he kind of points at the government as being this kind of watchdog, and it's like, yeah, but that's your government. Like,
yeah.
That's your government. It's not someone else's government that you're trying to rebel against. It's your own government that's being a watchdog to be, you know, proactive militarily and you know protect its citizens, and you're like, yeah, but let's go under the radar.
Yeah,
it's like what?
Whatever happened to the good old days when we could send an agent in to overthrow an entire government on its own? Because of drones and cameras, everyone can see everything. So let's shrink down, and that way we can do our black ops government overthrow with absolutely no oversight whatsoever. I was just like, okay, you're just being, it's not even like Loki where you're like, oh, he's a guy who just wants to impress his dad. It's like, oh, Corey Stahl's just crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Because that's the only, but then of course I'm thinking like, did he like walk up to his marketing team and literally say, I want to animate a thing where a guy in the yellow jacket suit just murders everyone. And then I want to find a guy with a really severe voice to do a voiceover that sounds like a despotic future. We cool with that? Great. We're going to make millions.
Billions.
Yeah. But, you know, aside from that, I enjoyed this movie. I thought that the humor was on the mark. There was one scene where I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be humorous or not, but it went on for so long that I assumed it was.
Ooh, which one?
We'll get into it in spoilers.
Okay.
Oh, man.
I found that Paul Rudd was a really good addition to the Marvel Universe. He's like a more kind of relaxed, is this the right way to put this? Imagine Chris Pratt in Guardians of the Galaxy, and just imagine him a little more everyman, because he's not like a galaxy surfing pirate.
Is that the character or is that Paul Rudd?
Paul Rudd and the character.
Okay.
Like Chris Pratt, like Paul Rudd is just a little more, like Chris Pratt when he was Andy on Parks and Rec was a great everyman, but now I can't look at him without thinking of like, you are the alpha male and all men aspire to be you. But Paul Rudd, I'm just like, I can still see Paul Rudd in a bar and be like, I bet he's cool. I don't want to be him, but I like him. So I enjoy Paul Rudd. I think that this movie has struck a balance of fitting into the universe without being a slave to the universe.
Which is funny because it seems like, oh God, I'm going to bring him up again.
Edgar
but
Wright.
It seems like that's exactly what Wright basically. Now, those are very, very sketchy details of what has come out. But I mean, it seems like that was part of the reason why he left was because they were trying to fit him into that mold. And he was like, no, like, let me do this. I don't know.
There's only one or two scenes where that seems like it's a real thing. And they weren't that egregious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like Iron Man 2 or, you know, there's ways where these movies like have gone off the rails. And I think Ant-Man really bounces out well.
It does.
So I would have to I give a thumbs up to this movie. I would say that Michael Peña alone is worth the price of admission.
Absolutely.
I love Bobby Cannavale. I love the fact that, oh God, all right, let's bring up Judy Greer for a second.
She's been in two blockbuster movies.
She has had a hell of a summer on paper, but then you see the movies she's in and it's like, oh, you're in this too. Well, I wasn't expecting that.
Oh, I thought you meant like screen time, because she gets like
total. That's what I'm saying. Like, why would an actress who is Judy Greer apply to be in these movies for like 12 seconds each?
I don't know.
And then, I mean, that's not even talking about Tomorrowland, which was not financially successful, but was still a massive movie that I think you can see like her hand and hear her voice.
Wait, who does she play?
In Tomorrowland?
Don't get into spoilers.
She's the mom in the videotape.
I'm picturing nothing.
There's a videotape in Tomorrowland where the little girl's like, I want to be an astronaut. And I think it, like, Judy Greer is like saying something or laughing. And one of the parents says, what if there's like nothing up there? And the little girl says, what if everything is up there? And it's like, Judy Greer is in that videotape, like barely. And then apparently she had like more of a role, but she's not in the movie at all.
Okay.
And I was like, is that Judy Greer? Did they just bring her in for ADR work?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what's up with Judy Greer. But I did like the fact that in this movie, the dynamics of a family that has gone through divorce are addressed in a realistic way. And that the new husband is allowed to be a foil to the main character without being a villain.
I like that too. Yeah. I did like that she is supportive without being supportive without being kind of I can't even
delusional?
Think of the word. Yeah, well, like she's
a firm hand.
Sure. We'll go with that.
Yeah. She's like, I love you, or I loved you, and I want you to be part of our daughter's life, but you got to get your act together. Our daughter cannot be hanging out with a con man who has no money. You know, she needs support. She needs financial support. And you need to step up and be a father in the way that you're allowed to be. And it makes sense. And it's a good foil. It provides a good through line for him and Hank Pym. I think that this movie is partially Marvel trying to overcome its women problem. And there is a post-credit sequence that I think like addresses that head on, but unfortunately it follows a movie where the men are literally shoving the woman out of the way and being like, no, you can't be the hero. Sorry.
I think they do a good job of establishing those kind of stakes though, but for the first hour of the movie you're like, okay, why is she in this movie?
And I understood what they were going for, and there's actually, I said to myself, a line that gets said later in the movie, which again is cool, but at the same time this is coming off a string of like I don't even know how many movies now, well over 10 I assume, in which women have been marginalized or overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, there's an end credit sequence, one of two, where they literally say what I think every person who's been looking forward to a actual female superhero in these films. Because I will say, Black Widow is a hero, not superpowered.
Yep.
Not even given a super suit. Tony Stark could whip her something up, but he's like, no, you seem to be doing good with spandex and a gun. You too, yeah, Hawkeye. Is, that, screw off. I'm not giving you any of this plate armor.
Wow. Holy shit. You know what? That's actually a point that I never considered.
I never thought
considered.
Of it either until I just said it. And now I want to delete it just so I can write the hot take.
Where are these extra suits and why are they not helping?
Why is not like Tony doesn't have to make them like their own super suit per se, but he could give them like something.
There's the Iron Patriot is rolling around there. Yeah. Come on.
I've got my army of robots. You can keep with your spandex and your shock batons and you'll be fine, right? Yeah, Tony, no. Thanks. I don't need like a lightly armored super suit. Yeah, I didn't think you did. All right, I'm going to drive away. I'm going to get drunk. Bye. Ah.
You know what? I don't think they've ever established the Avengers sharing technology and like weaponry. Like I would love for them to show like them up at Avengers Tower and like Black Widow like looking at Tony's armament and he like coming in and be like, "No. None of this is for you. You stay out of here."
Now that I'm thinking it's like, about that, what? Is really fucked up.
Like like they should share some of their technology.
If Tony's working with them, he could lend them out some stuff, right? Like he could put a kill switch on it or something.
All it would take is for Hawkeye to shoot like a bow and arrow at something, have it explode, and be like, "Wow, that is really cool tech, Tony," or something like that. Just make it like a throwaway line where like, you're just like, "Oh, thanks for
Tony. These time delayed explosive incendiary arrow tips that you made for me are really great."
Yeah.
Instead
something
of like
that.
Yeah, I'm still using this government issue shit. Oh, wow. Well, this is kind of blowing my mind. I'd never thought about the fact that Tony Stark is riding around in like basically a tank. Then he's still like, "Hey, Natasha, no. Sorry. You've got your neoprene."
Danny, thoughts?
This is stunning.
I think we've broken this wide open. But anyway, in general, I quite enjoyed this movie. I think that it was so weird to see David Dastmalchian. I don't know if I've said that right. I probably didn't.
Who was
but he? He plays the Russian
Joker?
Computer hacker.
Yes. Yeah, he plays the fake Joker.
Oh, yeah, he was hilarious.
In Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Well, oh, yeah, and he's in Prisoner.
He was also, like, creepy dude in Prisoners.
Yeah.
And so it was so weird to see him as, like, over-the-top Russian caricature in Ant-Man.
Is he Russian? He doesn't... nothing about his facial features strikes me as Russian.
It strikes me as Eastern European.
Sure.
I think Russian.
But not Russian.
Maybe like some Czech in him, maybe a little bit.
Wikipedia says American. Well, I
mean, you know, citizenship-wise, but...
This is a master performer.
But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed this movie. Obviously, there are some issues that I've had, and now I can't stop thinking about poor Black Widow just like constantly saying, "Hey, Tony, that's a pretty nice suit. I bet it wouldn't take you too long to make a suit like that for all of us, would it?
Could I have some gauntlets too?
Could you at least like make me a bulletproof vest because I'm a mortal woman who is fighting amongst a bunch of people who have superpowers and constantly getting shot at by lasers?" But in general, yeah, I enjoyed this movie. Also, shout out to the digital de-aging done to Michael Douglas during that first scene.
Oh, my God.
Because that was some convincing-ass shit.
I was not expecting... like, they didn't highlight that in any of the trailers. I didn't hear any of that in, like... I didn't really read any reviews, but I didn't get any of that kind of reaction stuff. And it blew my mind.
It was really good.
I've seen it in other films, like Genesis. And
I was about to say X-Men.
Yeah, X-Men.
The third one.
Yeah, the third one. Yeah, I remember that not being all that great. And the one that really comes to mind for me is Tron Legacy. And I thought Tron Legacy was okay. It looked a little goofy, but it was really kind of one of the first times that it was really shown. And they nail it here. And it's just kind of one of these throwaway things where you're just like, "Oh, that's happening right now." Like, there's no build up. There's no lead into it. It's just like, here he is and he's young.
Yeah.
And you're like,
literally
oh,
like first scene of the movie. I'm just like, "Oh shit. Disclosure, Michael Douglas up in my screen. I won't lie, I had to fan myself. And I thought that the age makeup that they put on Haley Atwell was also good.
And I still couldn't recognize her. I was just like, I think I'm supposed to recognize her, but.
And I'm always happy to see Martin Donovan in a movie.
Who is that?
Yeah,
he was a guy who was in S.H.I.E.L.D. at the beginning who his face punched. Yeah.
I also thought Greg Turkington had a really funny cameo as the Baskin Robbins boss.
Oh, yeah. in general, it's a fun movie. We can talk about it a little more in spoilers, but I don't think there's really a lot to say that would change your opinion or enhance it in any way. If you're interested, this is kind of what I always say for the Marvel films. If you're interested, check it out. If you're not, don't bother, because you probably won't like it.
I would say just on a comedic level, you'll probably enjoy this movie.
Yeah,
if you're into the kind of spy caper comedy.
Yeah, the fact that this is just like a straight caper film, like it elides over, for the most part, the exhausting trait that most of these films have, where the final 30 minutes is just CGI shit hitting itself.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The Avengers 2 ending, not there. Even as much as I loved Winter Soldier, it still had an ending that had a bunch of stuff crashing into it. Luckily, it focused on, like, a mano-a-mano, you know, highly emotionally driven thing going on. But it was still like, oh, it's so big and so loud. Guardians of the Galaxy, likewise, had, like, a thing crashing into a planet. This one, just two men fighting for what they believe in, slash, you know, one of them just wants a lot of money and might have gone crazy.
And the good thing is that they keep playing with these kind of visual gags throughout the film. So it's a lot of action and it's a lot, you know, kind of thrown onto you, but it's a lot of fun to watch just in general.
And it's stuff that you haven't seen because the way they manipulate scale.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our review of Ant-Man. We're going to talk spoilers and then we're going to get out of here. So spoilers for Ant-Man. The thing I was talking about with Evangeline Lilly, just like the whole movie, like the most competent person in the room, and all of the men are like, no, no.
One thing I did like was that it hinted at her having a relationship with Corey Stoll, but it never threw it in your face to the point where, you know, you see them kissing or you see them being intimate just for the sake of knowing that she's basically betraying him and using that as kind of her, you know, in with him.
Right. It wasn't like your superpower is that this guy wants to bone you.
Yeah.
No, it legitimately seemed like he knew she was smart. He knew that they were both kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like rejected by her father. And so he felt for her that way. You know, there may have been something going on, but you know, that was not her thing. And I, you know, like I said, the ending of this movie, the first post-credit sequence is, you know, Hank finally showing her the Wasp prototype suit and saying, like, you know, I think, you know, we can fix this up and you can wear it and be a superhero. And she's like, it's about time. And you can hear the entire world going, yes, Marvel, you're goddamn right. It is about time. especially because it, like, yes, in the movie, you know, I figured it out earlier, and then Paul Rudd comes out and says it, like, you don't understand, I'm expendable. He'd rather that this whole thing goes to shit than risk losing you. It's like, yeah, but did you not see the creepy-ass YouTube video that he showed that says that he basically wants to destroy the world? Like, I understand, like, a father's love for his daughter, but it seems like maybe the stronger message would be if he believed in her enough to believe that he wouldn't lose her. I don't know, guys. It was a little, it didn't really work for me in its entirety, but I could appreciate what they were going for.
I think it's a rough spot for sure. I think the fact that they kind of placate her character by giving her the suit at the end is kind of it's like, oh, so now it's okay? Like, well, wait, why is it now okay?
Part of it might be because of the way she equipped her... Equipped? Acquitted? the way she acted during the problems that were going on. Like, she obviously proved herself to be what she always knew she was and what her father couldn't see because he only saw her as her daughter, his daughter. So I could see that. Maybe, I don't know. It's difficult to say.
Yeah.
I want to believe the best in this movie because it's obvious that it knows that it's been the Marvel Universe has been having problems. And it's great that they acknowledge that. But it's still just like, it's a little regressive. And like in another movie, maybe I would have given it a pass. But because this has been such a sprawling universe.
And it's been by one studio overall. Yeah.
You know, you'd think you would have picked up on it a little bit. I don't know. Because really, they've only got Natasha Romanoff, a.k.a. the Black Widow. Like, that's pretty much it. You've got Sif, the warrior princess in the Thor movies.
And she's doing a whole lot of nothing.
Like, no, nothing. She's in, like, one scene, and then it's over.
Yep.
So I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. But this is... It's an issue. What else? Oh, let's talk about that scene that I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be funny or moving.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a scene where Paul Rudd is riding his flying ant, known as Antony.
Uh-huh.
And the bad guy surreptitiously, because there's no way he was aiming for him, shoots Antony out from under Paul Rudd.
Yep.
The bullet passes, like, doesn't even, like, the bullet crushes this ant. Like, just, it's not like the ant's, like, dying. The ant is just destroyed. Paul gets picked up by another ant, and he's like, Antony, no! And he looks over his shoulder, and there's one little ant wing falling. And I swear to God, they spent, like, 30 seconds...
Like, it is a very dramatic fall, and it's funny because they never touch on Antony again.
No.
And they never like he does say right as soon as he lands on this other ant that's gonna fly him towards the helicopter, he does say, you're gonna pay for that. But like beyond that, they focus on this little wing that's falling, and you're
so
like
so much.
You're like, oh, okay, so like Antony didn't die, or like, oh, no. You're gonna call back to
100%
it,
100% dead. That wing is the only thing that survived the bullet. But it was just so, like, weird because I was like, you know, in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, when the ant fights the scorpion to keep the kids safe,
yeah,
and that ant died. When I was a kid, that fucking crushed me. I was a wreck after that movie. I don't even remember most of what happens in that movie after that. Like, Antony, they called him. He's just like, oh my God. But then in this movie, like, you kind of get to like Antony, and then the bullet hits him, and I'm like, oh no, I can't believe they killed Antony. But then the fact that they focused on the wing falling so much, I was like, this has to be a comedy beat.
There's literally no way. No, I don't think it was a comedy beat. I think it was supposed to be dramatic. I think it was one of those few scenes that fell through the cracks of like, hey, what are we going for tonally here?
I choose to believe that it's a comedy beat because the whole like Paul Rudd being like, Antony, no, you're gonna pay for that. It reminds me of like if you have a pencil and you're like, I name this pencil Steve, and then your friend throws the pencil in the fire. And you're like, Steve, no! And then you turn to your friend and you're like, you're going to pay for that, you son of a bitch. Like, in a joking way, but you're not going to throw your friend in the fire because he threw your pencil into it.
I think what it does is it gives dramatic stakes right there and then that some of these creatures are expendable. Because the only issue I see happening is when they start to really duke it out and the ants start attacking Yellow Jacket.
Yeah.
And he's just like obliterating this army of ants.
And I felt
like,
bad just, for those ants.
I did too, because I was like, these are kind of like mindless creatures that are helping him.
That's the other messed up thing. These ants aren't his friends. He's literally controlling them with his mind.
Exactly.
So they're not even like anti in Honey, no. I Shrunk the Kids.
Exactly. They are not autonomous at all. They are just following orders. And so they're giving their life for him. And I think it'd be really difficult to have the stakes of Anthony dying in that sequence, because that sequence is played for so much humor.
Yeah.
That it
would feel bad
work.
For the ants. I won't lie.
Yeah. I
so
felt
here's
bad
the
for
thing.
Him too.
He feels bad for Anthony getting shot every time that he supersized himself while he was like under the lawn in an ant colony. It
oh,
must
yeah.
have been like 17 9/11s at once for those poor ants. But yeah, but I don't know. I chose to believe that was a comedy beat. I took it. I liked it. If it's not a comedy beat and I misread it, then I'm a sociopath. And
I think
that's
so.
Also a possibility. Any other spoilery things that we want to talk about? I will say that I did enjoy the last scene of the movie, not the post-credits scenes, but when Michael Pena is doing his shtick again.
Yeah.
About Hawkeye. Hawkeye? No, not Hawkeye. Anthony Falcon's character.
Yeah.
Falcon.
God, so many freaking animals. Falcon is looking for him, and I love how in all those scenes Michael Pena is doing his thing, and he's like, I was at a wine tasting, and you know, it was all whites and reds, which sucks because you know I love rosés. And then he's like, we were at this postmodern expressionist, and there was this one Rothko. Just like
the best part of those entire sequences is the fact that he's the voiceover.
Yes, the
that you
syncing.
Hear. And so, like, every single time it's a woman or it's a man, like, it doesn't matter. At one point, it's Stan Lee, of course, and you're just like, I love these sequences so much.
I feel like Anthony Mackie, in keeping with being, like, one of my favorite actors in Hollywood, like, plays up that fact so much in his point, because he's like, I know it's Michael Pena's voice, so let me say this like I'd imagine Michael Pena would imagine me saying it while making his voice. Oh my god.
So I got a couple of things. One sequence that I really enjoyed was when Paul Rudd first really kind of takes on the Ant-Man suit, and he goes through this long journey, and he ends up riding this ant to get out of prison. And when he wakes up, he's in Hank Pym's bedroom or guest room or wherever he is at, and Evangeline Lilly is just like standing over him on the phone for like a minute, and she doesn't say a word, and you can hear her like sending texts and like punching the letters on her phone, and I thought that was hilarious. But when he tries to get up out of bed, there's this sequence of the ants being on the floor.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it looked in your screening, but the two times I've seen it, I saw it once in 3D for the press screening, and then I saw it again in 2D, and those ants look absolutely terrible.
It looked like a screensaver, honestly.
They look like a blurry mess, and I was thinking that that was something that maybe it was tweaked wrong in the 3D post-conversion or something, but
possible.
Having seen it in 2D, it stays blurry, and I'm just kind of flabbergasted by the
ants.
Fact that this is, I know, but like this entire film looks so crisp and it looks so good, and you have this one sequence where he's like stepping over ants and they focus on the ants.
Yeah, and the ants kind of move out of the way of his feet.
And it looks bad.
It does. Like it does look bad. But that one scene compared to everything else they do.
Sure.
I guess. Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, there's the I don't know. I really honestly can't tell you. It does look kind of bad. I also love the fact that his daughter now has like a dog-sized ant.
That's going to be trouble.
Adorable.
That's going to be trouble.
That's one messed up looking dog.
What was the other thing that I was going to mention? Danny, did you have anything in particular?
Well, I really like the scene when he first breaks into Pym's safe, where goes through the one door, and because that's just sort of like a classic heist sequence with, you know, obviously the humor of him working really hard to open the one door, and then he has another one, and then he opens that one, and there's nothing except this random costume.
Which he takes.
Yeah, he does.
He's like, I went through all this trouble. I'm taking this weird-ass motorcycle suit.
So that was sort of a standout sequence.
Yeah. I'd say overall, you know, light movie, but enough good standout sequences to recommend to people who are interested in it.
The other thing that I wanted to mention was they mentioned throughout the film that going subatomic is this really, really, like,
I keep forgetting that the sequence happened.
Death wish kind of moment. Like, don't mess with the regulator. If you do,
don't cross the streams.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing.
The idea is that basically once you go subatomic, once you break your regulator and just try to become subatomic, you continue down that path. You don't have any regulator kind of rebound. You don't have any stuff. You're basically taking off the brakes of your shrinking ability.
Right.
And so you just shrink into infinity, basically. And they make the stakes very real. That scene
that's how their mom died.
Yeah. And I thought that scene works pretty well. And so they established the stakes, and as soon as Scott realizes that he's going to have to go to some atomic level to basically beat Yellow Jacket once and for all, which was just a brutal scene.
Yeah.
When he decides to do that, there is no hesitation. There is absolutely no, you know, montage. There's no, like, flashback memory. There's nothing.
He doesn't stare at his daughter for 5 minutes.
No, he just goes for it. And I love the fact that
hero.
Like, I love the fact that they threw that in. They have already established all the stakes. They have already established that his daughter is in the room, everything like that. And they're just like, if he was really there and he was really had that opportunity, he wouldn't hesitate, you know? Yeah. And I thought the fact that the way that he got out of that situation was also pretty clever. They established that they have these two different discs, which is another hilarious scene when he makes
Thomas the Tank Engine.
I was going to say that one, but when he's first trying it out and he makes that lawn gnome really, really big.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just a very awkward lawn gnome that's like laying down in the, in the Jeff Goldblum,
human-sized Jeff Goldblum style.
I thought that was really clever the way that they kind of established that and then bring him out of it.
Yeah.
So.
And then again, at the end, like, you know, he's a part of the family, but he's not. It's not like a Jim Carrey movie where he's somehow defeated the new husband and is back.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's sitting down at their dinner or at their breakfast table. Yeah. It's kind of awkward.
Liar, liar. It's Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
There's your other thing, Peeves.
There it is. I know. Gotta do that.
I'd like
Portrayal
the girl,
of mixed
too.
Families, and the girl is a good actor.
Yeah.
And of course,
really
Bobby Cannavale can't. What can you say about him? He's great. I think that's about it. I don't think I have anything else to say.
Danny, what did you think about the villain?
I thought he was good.
Crazy immediately, but
I enjoyed how sort of jacked up he was. Villain, I mean, like the scene with is it a lamb or a goat?
Oh,
I think it's
God.
A goat.
When he first uses that little gun and he turns that guy into just tiny little blob. I was really stunned by that because I was like, wait, they just
showed
killed
man
him
being like
in the bathroom. Yeah. Straight up murder.
Though I will say that my audience reacted more to the lamb being liquefied than the man.
Oh,
is a little weird.
Yeah. And then
showing how immediately nutty this guy is. The second that they actually shrink a lamb and he picks up the little glass cage, he flicks it. Like a dick. Because that's what
he was just trying to make sure it was real, man.
Yeah, he's like, if I flick this thing and it explodes, that's not, it doesn't count. Now, that's another question. What's that lamb's life like now? Did they bring it back? They must have, right? Because that's got to be the other half of the test.
Well, yeah, it's got to be part of it, right?
Or there's like just a little kid with a little lamb farm. like an ant farm, but with a lamb.
Just a lot of little ones.
Little tiny lambs.
That eventually will explode into just goop.
Yeah, probably. That'd be awful. Like 10 years later, the lamb explodes. It's like, oh no. All right. Well, that's it for Ant-Man. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. We're going to talk very briefly about Blu-ray releases, and then I will tell you where you can find us online, and then we'll be out of here until next week. It's going to Blu-ray. Not a lot. Not a lot. We have What We Do in the Shadows, which we talked about previously.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fun movie coming to Blu-ray. We got My Beautiful Laundrette that's coming to Blu-ray Criterion. And it's kind of it for new releases. We have Wild Horses, which I don't think I remember.
Yeah, that got bad reviews.
Robert Duvall, James Franco.
Yeah, I would only watch it because Duvall actually directed it.
Okay. I will say, special spotlight on Hoo-Ha.
Yeah, that's a really good movie.
Yeah, and that is starring Viggo Mortensen. So check that
really?
Out.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It's supposed to be very good. I don't remember who it's by. Danny, do you remember that?
Yeah, his name's Lisandro Alonso. And it's like his previous films have all been with non-actors, so it's interesting him working with Viggo, and the results are quite good.
Yeah, the IMDb summary says, a father and daughter journey from Denmark to an unknown desert that exists in a realm beyond the confines of civilization.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's supposed to be really good. I would say people check it out. I'm looking forward to being able to check it out. But other than that, yeah, it's not a lot. Not a lot coming out this week.
I thought Ex Machina just came out. That was last week?
That was the 14th. Ex Machina and It Follows came out on the same week as Paul
nice.
Blart 2.
Oh.
And The Longest Ride and The Second Best Marigold Hotel.
I can probably guess who was the top seller, and it was probably Paul Blart.
Or The Longest Ride. I don't know, man. Those
maybe.
Nicholas Sparks movies, they sell.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys. Okay, so this is random. So the one of the leads in Longest Ride is Scott Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like looking him up recently, and I was brought to the scene in Gran Torino where Clint like pulls up in his truck and like saves the girl from the like neighborhood gangsters or whatever.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But if you remember, she's walking with this like white guy who's acting like a gangster.
Is that Scott?
That's Scott Eastwood.
Oh my god,
wow.
That's amazing.
There's an interaction in the scene where Clint like turns to him and he's like, shut up, pussy. Like, what's with this gangster shit? And it's like, that's his son.
Oh my god. I need to watch that immediately.
Yeah, it's like I couldn't believe I was just learning that fact.
All right. Well,
that's great.
That's awesome. Come back next week. We might be talking about The Tribe. I don't know.
I hope so.
Yes, at some point, probably. other than that, I don't like. Because what else is coming out next week? Like Pixels? We're not talking about that.
Oh god,
Southpaw. I've heard it's terrible.
I liked it.
I'm definitely seeing Southpaw.
It'll probably be The Tribe. I don't know. Come back and find out what we're gonna watch. It's a mystery. Let's tell the people where we can be found at home before then. Bill Graham.
You can follow me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find my writings, mostly do interviews on the film stage. And that's it.
Dan King.
Twitter at the King Bulletin, filmstage.com, and all over the news channels and radio stations.
I don't believe you. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, also at thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net, and yeah, that's about it.
Are you a red or a white guy?
I don't know what that means.
Or a rosé?
Oh, I'm a red guy in that case, yeah. And I hate Rothko. My God, what is the point? What is the goddamn point? I love you, Michael Pena, but I do not understand that at all. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Tune in to True Detective tonight at 9 p.m. And look forward to seeing you next week.